Life is complex. Join us for the simple gifts of wisdom, love, and delight in the written word. The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Part 2. On the Man Called Christ. Conclusion. The summary of this book. Part 1. I have taken the liberty, once or twice, of borrowing the excellent phrase about an outline of history. Though this study of a special truth and a special error can, of course, claim no sort of comparison with the rich and many-sided encyclopedia of history for which that name was chosen. And yet, there is a certain reason in the reference, and a sense in which the one thing touches and even cuts across the other. For the story of the world as told by Mr. Wells could here only be criticized as an outline. And strangely enough, it seems to me that it is only wrong as an outline. It is admirable as an accumulation of history. It is splendid as a storehouse or treasury of history. It is a fascinating disquisition on history. It is most attractive as an amplification of history. But it is quite false as an outline of history. The one thing that seems to me quite wrong about it is the outline, the sort of outline that can really be a single line, like that which makes all the difference between a caricature of the profile of Mr. Winston Churchill and of Sir Alfred Mond. In simple and homely language, I mean the things that stick out, the things that make the simplicity of a silhouette. I think the proportions are wrong. The proportions of what is certain as compared with what is uncertain, of what played a great part as compared with what played a smaller part, of what is ordinary and what is extraordinary, of what really lies level with an average and what stands out as an exception. I do not say it as a small criticism of a great writer, and I have no reason to do so. For in my own much smaller task, I feel I have failed in very much the same way. I am very doubtful whether I have conveyed to the reader the main point I meant about the proportions of history, and why I have dwelt so much more on some things than others. I doubt whether I have clearly fulfilled the plan that I set out in the introductory chapter. And for that reason, I add these lines as a sort of summary in a concluding chapter. I do believe that the things on which I have insisted are more essential to an outline of history than the things which I have subordinated or dismissed. I do not believe that the past is most truly pictured as a thing in which humanity merely fades away into nature, or civilization merely fades away into barbarism, or religion fades away into mythology, or our own religion fades away into the religions of the world. In short, I do not believe that the best way to produce an outline of history is to rub out the lines. I believe that, of the two, it would be far nearer the truth to tell the tale very simply, like a primitive myth about a man who made the sun and stars, or a god who entered the body of a sacred monkey. I will therefore sum up all that has gone before in what seems to me a realistic and reasonably proportioned statement, the short story of mankind. In the land lit by that neighboring star, whose blaze is the broad daylight, there are many and very various things, motionless and moving. There moves among them a race that is in its relation to the others a race of gods. The fact is not lessened, but emphasized, because it can behave like a race of demons. Its distinction is not an individual illusion, like one bird pluming itself on its own plumes. It is a solid and a many-sided thing. It is demonstrated in the very speculations that have led to its being denied, that men, the gods of this lower world, are linked with it in various ways is true. But it is another aspect of the same truth. That they grow as the grass grows and walk as the beasts walk is a secondary necessity that sharpens the primary distinction. It is like saying that a magician must, after all, have the appearance of a man, or that even the fairies could not dance without feet. It has lately been the fashion to focus the mind entirely on these mild and subordinate resemblances, and to forget the main fact altogether. It is customary to insist that man resembles the other creatures. Yes, and that very resemblance he alone can see. The fish does not trace the fishbone pattern in the fowls of the air, or the elephant and the emu compare skeletons. Even in the sense in which man is at one with the universe, it is an utterly lonely universality. The very sense that he is united with all things is enough to sunder him from all. Looking around him by this unique light, as lonely as the literal flame that he alone has kindled, this demigod or demon of the visible world makes that world visible. He sees around him a world of a certain style or type. It seems to proceed by certain rules, or at least repetitions. He sees a green architecture that builds itself without visible hands, but which builds itself into a very exact plan or pattern, like a design already drawn in the air by an invisible finger. It is not, as is now vaguely suggested, a vague thing. It is not a growth or a groping of blind life. Each seeks an end, a glorious and radiant end. Even for every daisy or dandelion we see, in looking across the level of a common field, in the very shape of things there is more than green growth. There is the finality of the flower. It is a world of crowns. This impression, whether or no it be an illusion, has so profoundly influenced this race of thinkers and masters of the material world that the vast majority have been moved to take a certain view of that world. They have concluded, rightly or wrongly, that the world had a plan, as the tree seemed to have a plan, and an end and crown like the flower. But so long as the race of thinkers was able to think, it was obvious that the admission of this idea of a plan brought with it another thought more thrilling and even terrible. There was someone else, some strange and unseen being, who had designed these things, if indeed they were designed. There was a stranger who was also a friend, a mysterious benefactor who had been before them and built up the woods and hills for their coming, and had kindled the sunrise against their rising, as a servant kindles a fire. Now this idea of a mind that gives a meaning to the universe has received more and more confirmation within the minds of men by meditations and experiences much more subtle and searching than any such argument about the external plan of the world. But I am concerned here with keeping the story in its most simple and even concrete terms. And it is enough to say here that most men, including the wisest men, have come to the conclusion that the world has such a final purpose, and therefore such a first cause. But most men, in some sense, separated themselves from the wisest men when it came to the treatment of that idea. There came into existence two ways of treating that idea, which between them make up most of the religious history of the world. The majority, like the minority, had this strong sense of a second meaning in things, of a strange master who knew the secret of the world. But the majority, the mob or mass of men, naturally tended to treat it rather in the spirit of gossip. The gossip, like all gossip, contained a great deal of truth and falsehood. The world began to tell itself tales about the unknown being or his sons, or servants, or messengers. Some of the tales may truly be called old wives' tales, as professing only to be very remote memories of the morning of the world. Myths about the baby moon, or the half-baked mountains. Some of them might more truly be called travelers' tales, as being curious but contemporary tales brought from certain borderlands of experience, such as miraculous cures, or those that bring whispers of what has happened to the dead. Many of them are probably true tales. Enough of them are probably true to keep a person of real common sense more or less conscious that there really is something rather marvelous behind the cosmic curtain. But in a sense, it is only going by appearances, even if the appearances are called apparitions. It is a matter of appearances and disappearances. At the most, these gods are ghosts. That is, they are glimpses. For most of us, they are rather gossip about glimpses. And for the rest, the whole world is full of rumors, most of which are almost avowedly romances. The great majority of the tales about gods and ghosts and the invisible king are told, if not for the sake of the tale, at least for the sake of the topic. They are evidence of the eternal interest of the theme. They are not evidence of anything else, and they are not meant to be. They are mythology, or the poetry that is not bound in books, or bound in any other way. Meanwhile, the minority, the sages or thinkers, had withdrawn apart and had taken up an equally congenial trade. They were drawing up plans of the world which all believed to have a plan. They were trying to set forth the plan seriously and to scale. They were setting their minds directly to the mind that had made the mysterious world, considering what sort of a mind it might be and what its ultimate purpose might be. Some of them made that mind much more impersonal than mankind has generally made it. Some simplified it almost to a blank. A few, a very few, doubted it altogether. One or two of the more morbid fancied that it might be evil and an enemy. Just one or two of the more degraded in the other class worshipped demons instead of gods. But most of these theorists were theists, and they not only saw a moral plan in nature, but they generally laid down a moral plan for humanity. Most of them were good men who did good work, and they were remembered and reverenced in various ways. They were scribes, and their scriptures became more or less holy scriptures. They were lawgivers, and their tradition became not only legal, but ceremonial. We may say that they received divine honors, in the sense in which kings and great captains in certain countries often received divine honors. In a word, wherever the other popular spirit, the spirit of legend and gossip, could come into play, it surrounded them with the more mystical atmosphere of the myths. Popular poetry turned the sages into saints. But that was all it did. They remained themselves. Men never really forgot that they were men, only made into gods in the sense that they were made into heroes. Divine Plato, like Divus Caesar, was a title and not a dogma. In Asia, where the atmosphere was more mythological, the man was made to look more like a myth, but he remained a man. He remained a man of a certain special class or school of men, receiving and deserving great honor from mankind. It is the order or school of the philosophers. The men who have set themselves seriously to trace the order across any apparent chaos in the vision of life. Instead of living on imaginative rumors and remote traditions and the tail end of exceptional experiences about the mind and meaning behind the world, they have tried, in a sense, to project the primary purpose of that mind a priori. They have tried to put on paper a possible plan of the world, almost as if the world were not yet made. Right in the middle of all these things stands up an enormous exception. It is quite unlike anything else. It is a thing final, like the trump of doom, though it is also a piece of good news, or news that seems too good to be true. It is nothing less than the loud assertion that this mysterious maker of the world has visited his world in person. It declares that really, and even recently, or right in the middle of historic times, there did walk into the world this original, invisible being, about whom the thinkers make theories and the mythologists hand down myths. The man who made the world.
'Tis the gift to be simple. 'Tis the gift to be free. 'Tis the gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend, we will not be ashamed. To turn, turn, will be our delight, till by turning, turning, we come round right.